Alan Stern and David Greenspoon back with us. Their new book is called Chasing New Horizons, and where you're going to take your phone calls with them next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. David Greenspoon, Alan Stern with us. We'll take your calls as well as we talk about Chasing New Horizons. David, how did they keep this spaceship warm enough to function way, way out there?
Well, that is one of the challenges. You know, there's so many things that have to be maintained just right over that long journey. And one is, you know, there's the thermal control is one of the, you know, there's a whole area of engineering in spacecraft design and function, which is, you know, paying attention to how hot and how cold things are. You know, there's a nuclear power source generating electricity, you have to make sure that everything is kept in just the right temperature range. But you know, there is power, and there's also, you can do a lot with just paying attention to the orientation of the spacecraft, and you know, what's facing the sun and what's facing away. And, you know, it's basically just something that you monitor, and it's an aspect of operating the spacecraft. It's keeping it in the right temperature range so everything can function correctly.
Let's go to the calls. Here's Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. And, gentlemen, he is an amateur astronomer, but he's probably a pro by now. Hey, Bill, go ahead.
Yes, hi, George. Hi. It's a great pleasure to be on your show again.
Thank you.
Alan and David, in addition to being an amateur astronomer, I've been a member of Bill Nye's Planetary Society since the 1980s when Dr. Carl Sagan was part of it. So I'm an expert on space science and space exploration. And I have two great questions for you. The first one is on the European Trace Gas Orbiter. That's an orbit around Mars now looking for methane in conjunction with what you mentioned earlier in the show regarding Curiosity's findings today that was put out by NASA today. And the second question involves the Europa Clipper mission to go out to Jupiter, to orbit Jupiter and fly by many times the moon Europa, and my question has to do with a lander, potential lander on it. So question number one, do you know if the trace gas orbiter has the ability, does it have the ability to distinguish methane, assuming I'm saying this correctly chemically, carbon-12 as opposed to carbon-13, assuming I'm saying it correctly, so that it could determine if it finds methane all over Mars or in certain areas of Mars, whether it's from astrobiological origins, meaning life, as opposed to geological origins, geology. And then question number two about the Europa Clipper, which hopefully will be launched in 2022. Two things. Number one, will that mission, Europa Clipper, be able to use Texas Congressman John Culbertson's proposal to have a lander land on Europa with a life detection instrument on it, as well as B, will the Space Launch System rocket, the SLS huge rocket, be able to launch both the Europa Clipper and a lander to Europa to get there in 3 years as opposed to launching on a smaller, lighter rocket where it would take a lot longer to get to Jupiter?
Alan, do you want to try that?
Yeah, I'll take the Europa Clipper question, and David can take the one about the
methane
gas orbiter. I'm actually on the Europa Clipper mission, and let me update all your listeners, especially the questioner, about the thinking as it's evolved. You know, the Jovian environment, putting spacecraft in that environment is very demanding because there are very intense radiation fields from Jupiter's magnetosphere. And it's very hard to make electronics survive, even for a period of months in that environment. NASA's very interested in flying a lander to Europa, but I think wisely NASA has decided, and Congressman Culberson understands this very well, and I know him personally, and am so impressed with his passion for space exploration, and particularly for the search for life in ocean worlds. But NASA's decided to split those two missions, send the Europa Clipper first to scout out landing sites, and then send the lander in so that it doesn't have to wait in that radiation bath to come on a second rocket later and to go to the chosen landing site. So we're going to do a lander. That's the plan. Right now, NASA is selecting the instruments for it, so we can't say yet whether what kind of life detection or biology detection instruments will be aboard because they're evaluating proposals. But I think the lander is going to happen for sure, and I think in a smarter way than the first concept, which was to send it with the Clipper when we really didn't know where to put the lander down and we were going to have to make a very hurried decision.
All right, and let's. What was the other question, real fast, Bill?
Yes, real fast. I want to ask you regarding Enceladus and the Enceladus Life Finder. What are the chances in the early 2000s of getting a similar mission to fly to orbit Enceladus and go through the plumes of Enceladus, just like Cassini did, but with life detection instruments in it?
Who
well,
wants
there,
that?
There are actually there have been proposed. Proposed missions to Enceladus to do just that, try to fly through the plume material. So far, those missions have not been selected by NASA, I think largely because they've been perceived as pretty high risk. But that is a kind of mission that's being looked at, and obviously the plume of Enceladus is a juicy target for astrobiology because it's literally one of these interior oceans that is squirting out into space. So it's certainly a mission that we'll want to do at some point. I'm not sure if it's necessarily going to be on the docket in the next decade, but Enceladus will not avoid our exploration efforts for too much longer.
And Alan, you were one of those proponents of going to Pluto. Why did you pick that?
Well, as I like to tell people, I'm very big on exploration. And, the opportunity to be a part and to help make a new first mission to a brand new place and a new type of planet happen was just irresistible for me as a scientist. And also from the standpoint of being an explorer, to go to the farthest worlds ever explored, to go farther and deeper into space than had ever been attempted and make a flyby was just irresistible.
Okay, next up, let's go to Mary in Burlington County, New Jersey on the wildcard line. Mary, go ahead.
Hello, everyone. I have a question. Does our galaxy or other galaxies have a sun like our sun?
Well, the galaxy, our galaxy, the Milky Way, which we call the Milky Way, is actually made up of hundreds of billions of suns. So, you may be referring to other solar systems, other planetary systems. In which case, yes, each has a star. They're not exactly a sun necessarily like our sun because there are many different kinds of stars, but each has some kind of star in the center. And then a galaxy is made up of hundreds of billions of stars, and our Milky Way is one of hundreds of billions of galaxies in the universe.
Okay, Mary, does that help you?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Next up, let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you?
I am rolling along, Joe. Going to Vegas this weekend for my show.
Well, that'll be great. I know it. Alan, you mentioned organic molecules on Mars. Now, what does this mean in terms of easing our exploration of the planet Mars? What are the ramifications? And what does it really mean to the space program?
Well, it certainly means that the search for astrobiology, which David is an expert in, one of the world's experts, has gained new relevance at Mars. We looked for a long time and couldn't find those organics. Strangely enough, organic molecules have been found in the middle and outer solar system, places like the giant moon of Saturn called Titan. And even on Pluto's surface, we see organic molecules. and other places too, but not yet on Mars until now. And now we have definitive evidence for that. And so that's going to spur us to go look harder. And it's a clue to tell us what to do next. You know, with regard to human exploration, I think it's a kind of double-edged sword, though, because on the one hand, the organics, if they really mean that there was life there, are going to be an attraction to send humans to do the kind of things that robots aren't capable of doing. But we also have to be certain or very sure that we're not going to put people in harm's way if there could be life forms on the surface that might not be friendlies.
Okay, Joe, thank you. Appreciate you being on the show. Theodore in Baltimore, Maryland, east of the Rockies. Hey, Theodore, go ahead.
Good evening, gents. Got a question for you, sir.
Sure.
Last year, I was wondering, when I found out that, I think it was 2012, that both the Voyagers had gone out there and listening to you, I called NASA in Greenbelt, Maryland. And unfortunately, I looked at my call ID and I got a call back, and I didn't know who it was, so I just didn't answer. But I asked her a question. Our tax money is paying for those probes. Now, she did tell me before the first one I called initially. She said that both of the probes, Voyagers, had at least 10 years, maybe more, of power, and that they should be sending back pictures, though it takes a while. Since our tax money pays for those probes, does NASA have a right to withhold the pictures that is taken? Now, she told me, she said, Theodore, it's nothing out there. They're going between interstellar space, between suns or stars. She said it's nothing out. I said there's got to be something, some pictures that they're taking that they don't show the public. I want to ask you, do I have a right, not legally anything like that, freedom of information, but does the public, myself included, have a right to see the pictures of what it's taking out there? Because they're still taking pictures as they go until their energy runs out. Can you answer that one for me?
Go ahead, Alan. I'll let you take that, and I'm sure we do have a right to see.
Happy to do that, but let me first correct the misimpression. The two Voyager spacecraft are no longer operating their cameras. In fact, the cameras were disabled back in the 1990s because out there in the middle of nowhere, and after all, it's empty. That's why we call it space. The cameras were not useful scientific instruments, and the software to run the cameras was taken off of the two spacecraft so that we could put new software up to make the other instruments, the ones that are relevant at those great distances from the sun, those are called plasma spectrometers and magnetometers, to make them more effective. So the cameras can't even be operated on the Voyager anymore, and they haven't been for over 20 years. So there are no pictures that are being taken or sent back to Earth because the spacecraft's not even capable of using the cameras any longer.
And let me tell you, David and Alan, the fact that these missions are so prevalent and they seem to be so successful, how far are we ahead of all the others? And whatever happened to the Russians? How come they're not doing much anymore?
Well, we are.
Well, you know, the Russian space Dave, program... The Russian space program has a very proud, justifiably proud history. I mean, they did a lot of very important, had a lot of important accomplishments in early human space flight and the planetary program. You know, they landed spacecraft on Venus, which was amazing. They sent a mission to Comet Halley. They've done a lot of great things. You know, unfortunately, their planetary program is not in great shape now, just because largely for financial reasons. You know, their country just has not, you know, been investing in that. So they have not had a lot of great planetary launches in recent years. But they have huge expertise, you know, and some really accomplished and talented scientists. And of course, they have amazing engineering capabilities as well. So one hopes that in the future they'll be able to revive their planetary program. Who knows, maybe as part of an international cooperation. And of course, there are a lot of other countries getting into the game now, doing wonderful things. European Space Agency has some great planetary missions and some ambitious ones. planned, and as well the Japanese, the Indian Space Agency starting to do, launches the Chinese. So, it's a wonderful thing that a lot of countries are in the game. Now, it's also true that nobody is nearly as accomplished as the United States in space exploration. And, certainly New Horizons is evidence that our country is capable of doing what still nobody else is capable of doing. And it shows what we can do when we're really on our game. And it is something that I think that Americans can be really proud of, that we have such incredible excellence in space exploration.
Alan, it took 9 years to get New Horizons from launch date to Pluto. 9 years. And in those 9 years, I guess computer technology must have changed dramatically. What would it be like today with today's kind of technology?
Well, we would send more advanced probes, and we want to do that. We want to go back to Pluto with an orbiter and study it in more detail and really understand that ocean that we think is beneath the ice, and look at the surface activity and see what we can see over a period of time as things change. We want to map the terrains that New Horizons couldn't because they were in darkness on the day that we flew by, for example. But we also want to send new flyby missions, sort of like a second-generation New Horizons, to explore the other exotic planets out there in the Kuiper Belt. These places have names like Eris and Sedna and Makemake and Haumea. And they're just as diverse a population of planets as the planets close to the sun, like Venus and Mars and Mercury and Earth. And so we have a lot more exploring to do. And with this newer technology that we now have in the 20-teens, and even better technology we'll have in the 20s, we can jump way ahead in terms of our capabilities. And, just as we were more advanced with New Horizons than Voyager, this next generation of missions that I hope will fly will do even better.
Remember Buzz Aldrin needed to use his Bic pen to hit the button to launch the lunar module off the moon? Did you hear about that?
That's right. That's right. They had a busted, I think it was a circuit breaker.
And he couldn't put his finger in there or something.
Not in the spacesuit glove. It wouldn't fit. So he used the pen. That was very ingenious.
Low technology got him off the moon. It's pretty amazing. We're going to take a quick break pretty soon, and then we're going to come back with final phone calls. Amazing work. Is this the first book you two have collaborated with?
It sure is. David's written prize-winning, award-winning books before, and I've written some books before, but this is our first collaboration.
I think when you were on with me, Alan, back in, 2012, wasn't it?
I think that's right.
Something like that. We were talking about some of your other works. So we're going to be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take final phone calls. Next hour, we're going to talk about tarot cards, so make sure you stay with us. David Greenspoon with us, the astrobiologist, and Dr. Alan Stern with us, the principal investigator of the New Horizons mission, which, of course, is what we are talking about tonight. It's how big was it, Alan, in terms of size? Was it huge?
No, we wanted to build the smallest spacecraft we possibly could, because the smaller you build it, the faster the rocket can push it, and the quicker you can get across the solar system. New Horizons is about the size of a baby grand piano, and when we launched it, full of fuel, it weighed about 1,000 pounds.
Jeez, that's it. And what kind of fuel was it?
It's called hydrazine. It's what's called a monopropellant. Lets you have a very simple propulsion system, very reliable.
Okay, we're going to come back and take some final calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Our final segment with David Greenspoon and Alan Stern. Their book is called Chasing New Horizons. Alan, why does there seem to be such a void of going to the moon? How come?
Well, a long time ago, at the conclusion of the Apollo program, we the United States, voluntarily dismantled the capability to continue exploring the moon.
Why?
There was a backlash against, I think a lot of it was related to the Vietnam War as much as it was to space exploration, but it was very expensive back then, and NASA was taking up a pretty large fraction of the federal budget, I think about 5%, and the political climate was such that they dismantled the capability to build Saturn V rockets and lunar modules, and that cut us off from lunar exploration for a long time. And now we're rebuilding that capability, and not just within NASA, but also private companies like Blue Origin and SpaceX are building rockets. So is United Launch Alliance, that'll be capable of doing human lunar exploration again, even in the private sector. And I think that that's a really healthy development, because it's driving a lot of innovation, and it's giving us multiple ways to go about this that don't entirely rely on Uncle Sam.
And with the way things have been going, will China pass us up on that kind of exploration to the moon?
You know, if you'd asked me that 10 or 15 years ago, I was worried about it, but less so now, because of these developments in the private sector here in the United States that are more or less our fail-safe protection against that. We are way ahead of the Chinese in so many ways, in terms of deep space exploration, the kind of robotic stuff that New Horizons is a fantastic example of, but also in terms of human space flight. They are way behind, and I know they want to catch up, and they're going to pour a lot of resources into it, and we should check our six now and then. But if we keep going with the programs that NASA's pursuing and the private industry is pursuing, I think we'll stay ahead and maybe even pull further ahead.
Well, you know what's amazing? I mean, we went to the moon 49 years ago. 49 years ago, and nobody else has done this. I mean, that's how far ahead we were.
That's right. That's a very good point to make. It shows how far ahead we were back then. And it really was a 21st century enterprise plopped in the middle of the 20th century. And it was a bit ahead of its time in some respects. But now, with the technology that we have today, individual private companies can mount the kind of systems needed for private lunar exploration with astronauts, and even with, I think, not in the distant future, with space tourists.
All right, let's go back to the...
It's also true that no other country has landed successful landers on Mars. No other country has had the missions we've had to Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and no other country has explored the Kuiper Belt like we have with New Horizons. So there's, you know, there's a lot that that only the U.S. has been able to do in space exploration.
All right, let's go back to the calls. Let's go to Tom in Port Angeles, Washington, west of the Rockies. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
Hey, George, very exciting to get on, and I called just to ask about, you know, how fast we can push the speeds up. But let me throw in this. There's 9 Rocketdyne F1 engines that are never got used, and they're still in storage.
Okay.
And the tanks in all of the parts that we have left with the Apollo missions, they're going to hydrotest. They're probably good. But anyway, I called about, you know, everything we've learned about navigating in space would indicate that, you know, we can push those speeds way, way up. Space is very, very clean, and the odds of running into anything are millions to one. So I'm asking you guys, how fast are we going now, and how fast do we think we can push the speeds up if we can get a little, if we have the luxury of a little shielding on the spacecraft?
Well, you know, New Horizons, as David said, is the fastest spacecraft ever launched. And, you know, George told you that it took 9.5 years to cross the solar system. It's a three-plus billion-mile journey. That spacecraft was doing almost 1 million miles every day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. Think about that, almost 1 million miles a day. When we launched Apollo astronauts to the moon, 25,000 miles an hour, it took them 3 days to reach the moon. New Horizons only took 9 hours. Now, we have the technology to go even faster than that. And if we really want to push the pedal to the metal on technology with advanced electric propulsion, with nuclear propulsion, and even with laser propulsion, we can talk about going 10 times faster, maybe 100 times faster, in the coming couple of decades. And then we could cross the solar system to Pluto 100 times faster would be just a matter of weeks. Think about that.
Jeez, that would be astounding.
Stunning. But, of course, for the missions we want to fly, where we want to go into orbit or land on these faraway bodies, going fast is a benefit, but it's also a problem because it's hard to come to a stop when you're going that fast.
Let's go next to Walter in Pennsylvania. Hey, Walt, go ahead.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Donna wasn't sure whether you'd get to me.
Just enough time.
George, I just want to compliment you on having these fantastic people on that you have on this evening. George, I just wish you could, you know, I realize they can't stay on indefinitely. I mean, but, you know, as I was telling Donna, you know, your next segment's you're going to be talking about tarot cards, which is just absurdity, in my opinion.
Oh, so, a lot of people like that stuff, Walter.
Well, George, I know there's different strokes for different folks.
That's exactly right.
We could really concentrate with these eminent people like you have on this evening. George, if I may, you know, we're talking about velocities in space, and to me it's ironic that, you know, we're talking about developing these propulsion systems when you think of it, you know, in the Earth's orbiting of the sun, we are already going like 90 miles a second. So we are on essentially on our own spaceship. So it's ironic that, you know, we have to devise these, you know, high-tech propulsion systems when our planet Earth is already exceeding the velocities that, you know, we're attempting to aspire to. So, you know, it's really fantastic when you think about, you know, relative motion and in space, you know what I mean? I wonder what the doctors would...
Speed doesn't have much in space, does it? Alan?
Well, let me... first, let me thank the caller for the compliments about David and I, and we love...
And if you knew how to read tarot cards, I'd keep you on an extra hour.
That's not my... I don't think I can help you there. But I do know a good bit about orbital mechanics. The Earth's moving about 20 miles per second in its orbit, and we need the speed of the rockets to pull out of the Earth's gravity well, and then to pull out of the sun's gravity well to cross the orbits to other planets. And that's why we use this rocket technology. We have to, you know, it's always fighting gravity, and the way that the mathematics works out, it's all dependent upon the speed.
It sure does. In New Horizons, that was, what, 32,000 miles an hour?
That was our speed at Pluto. We were going, of course, even faster when we launched, and then when we got our Jupiter gravity assist, that was another boost.
How about anti-gravity machines? Are we ever going to get those?
I don't think we understand gravity well enough to make anti-gravity. Not with today's technology. Maybe in the future, but... That's way above my pay grade.
Let me ask both of you individually. You first, David. Do you believe that there is intelligent life out there?
I do. You know, the odds are really in the favor of evolution occurring elsewhere, just because, especially now with the exoplanets, we know there's so many places where evolution could be occurring, and we don't know of anything sort of magical or extremely unlikely about the evolutionary process on Earth. Intelligence, you know, cognitive ability is a good survival skill. And that's what evolution does, is it finds good survival skills and selects for them. So we won't know until we make that discovery. But if I had to guess based on what we do know, I would say it's very likely that something similar has evolved elsewhere.
How about you, Ellen?
I'm also very optimistic. I'm not the kind of expert David is in astrobiology, but as he says, I think all of us in the field realize that now that with missions like Kepler, we know that planets are ubiquitous in the galaxy and probably in the universe, that there are literally hundreds of billions, if not literally trillions of planets just in our own galaxy. The numbers just work that the odds of our being the only extant case of the development of life and then civilization, I think, are just very remote. And the challenge for us now, as we're getting this better and better technology, is to find where they are. You know, Enrico Fermi, the Nobel laureate, asked in the middle of the 20th century, just thinking about similar numbers games, he said, well, where are they? And now we're beginning to develop the technologies to find out the answer to that question. And I'm really looking forward to the next couple decades as we're able to really attempt that for the first time.
Let's go to Los Angeles. Hello, Tyler. Take it away.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Thank
sure
you.
Thing.
I feel NASA is exceptionally good or well at producing images you see on your computer and say, oh, that looks really neat. Now, you're talking about looking for gases and methane on moons, the planets millions and millions of miles away. As a taxpayer, what practical good is this doing me? And, I mean, does anybody feel that funds could be better spent on, you know, serving the people here on Earth?
Interesting question. That is a argument that a lot of people will take. How do you answer
that? I'll take a first crack at that. I think, you know, there's a way in which it is serving the people on Earth. I mean, it's our curiosity, our need to explore, our need to know. It's very human. You know, if we were, you know, expending half our resources on space exploration, you know, and neglecting everything on Earth, then, you know, that would be very troubling. In reality, it's a very small slice of the federal budget, and yet, you know, this knowledge is shared and celebrated by millions of people. Alan mentioned that, you know, the 2 billion web hits, you know, the day of the Pluto flyby. So there are apparently a lot of taxpayers who are pretty excited about this. And, you know, I think we certainly can mention practical benefits as far as the, you know, the technological innovations and the, you know, the discoveries we make, which make us smarter about how planets work, including Earth. But, you know, it really, on a very fundamental level, it's satisfying this human need. And, you know, since we have the ability, it strikes me that it would be, you know, kind of crazy not to go and not to explore and not to share this knowledge with humans now that we finally are at the stage where we can go and do it.
You know, and George, if I could add to that, you know,
please.
NASA's budget is much less than 1% of the federal budget each year. And so if you think about that, more than 99% are going to all the other things that we do here on Earth. Would another 0.5% or whatever fraction of a percent really make a credible difference? Whereas, in addition to developing the kind of knowledge that that David was talking about, you know, the fact that we put it out there for everyone, I mean we the United States, is tremendous soft power projection. Kids in every country, even enemy countries, the ones that want to see us do poorly or do us harm, they know about terms like Voyager and Apollo, and that's an American brand, and I think it's very important that we do that. And I also want to say that I think it's, you know, what space exploration does is it inspires young kids to something very hard, and that's science and engineering careers. And we need those scientists and engineers to fuel our economy. And I think more than anything else, the best byproduct on Earth of space exploration is the inspiration it gives to young people to go into these tech fields, which we so badly need.
And if we really wanted to do this, we could do both. We could do space, we could do education, we could do homeless people, we could do it all. We're not committed to do it all. We have that capability. I think we can help the entire planet and still do all our space programs. We need to we need to do that. Gentlemen, we're almost out of time.
Yep.
How about telling us again where we can get Chasing New Horizons? David?
Well, Chasing New Horizons is on sale really wherever you you buy your books. You can download it as an audiobook from Audible. You can get it certainly on, you know, the big online bookstores, and you can get it at your local independent store. It's widely available, and we think it's a great story, and we're excited to have it out there now, and we hope that a lot of people listening will check it out and give it a read.
Good for both of you. Alan, thank you. David, thank you for being on the program. Come back again, okay, you two?
George.
Thanks very much.
Absolutely. And let's not let so many years go by. In a moment, we're going to come back and talk about tarot cards. Everyone will be listening except Walton, Pennsylvania, but the audience continues to grow.